Welcome to Hallel Fellowship on the internet at hallel.info. Today's study explores the Torah reading Pinchas, covering Numbers chapter 25, verse 10 through 30, verse 1. This study dives into why believers are called to be biblical alphas in a world full of domineering, self-seeking, so-called alphas. The meek power wielded by Joseph, Moses, Elijah, Peter, and Yeshua teach us about how every word that proceeds from the mouth of God helps us avoid being betas who get caught up in the confusion spread by those who reject the source of true knowledge of good and bad.
I know it can be flippant to say that Phineas is giving them the point of the whole episode, but really that is a part of what the mission is in communicating this. It's a very important thing of where Pinchas stands up as a priest and deals with the situation. So one of the things we're going to be taking a look at today is something that brings these two passages together, that what we saw there in 1 Kings 18 and 19 and also in John chapter 2, is we see that really what we're talking about here is that believers in the creator of all things, creator of heaven and earth, you know, we cannot be bait people. They will talk about beta people. We can't be bait people in an Aleph world or an Alpha world. Now, what we can gather from these particular passages, particularly the passage that we looked at in 1 Kings chapter 18 and 19, is that being an Aleph or being an Alpha in the world does not mean just smacking people around, dropping the hammer sort of thing. No, because you get that illustration of it is a very similar encounter as you see what Eliyahu is having with the Lord there. It should sound very familiar. It should sound what we encountered in Exodus, where Moshe is having the encounter with the Lord. And the Moshe said to the Lord, "Show me your glory." And he says, "I'm going to make my goodness pass before you." And when he's passing by, he declares his glory. And you see in this passage with Eliyahu that you see these demonstrations of the Lord's power, you know, breaking the rocks, etc. But each of those times it's mentioned very in particular, the Lord was not in that. It was not in this. It was not in that. But what was it in? Small voice. Because when you talk about the big voice, you know, the Kol Gadol, that big voice there at Sinai, and that smoke, and the, you say we will do there in Exodus 19 to eventually down to verse 21, hey, Moshe, you talk to him, because we're afraid. Now, when we talk about being an Aleph, being an Alpha in being God's servants in the world, that means we step up when we should step up. We take responsibility when we are supposed to take responsibility. And that responsibility can come with a hammer on top of our own heads. We see the examples that we have of Yosef. He was an Alpha in the court of Pharaoh, in the house of Potiphar, standing up. Well, look, we could say, well, look what that got him. Well, when you see that, look what it did get him. He got accused of salacious behavior. He got thrown in prison. But in each of those cases, you get this emphasis that's saying, hey, the Lord is with him. The Lord is with him. And even the people around him recognized, hey, the Lord is with you. And so, even though he was kicked to the curb, kicked, thrown in prison, still what was brought to him? Positions of authority, responsibility. So that with Potiphar, he had command, Yosef had command of Potiphar's house. He said nothing that was there was not left to his responsibility. Why? Because he stepped up. He stepped up when it was needed to do so. Potiphar didn't have to micromanage him. in what he was doing. The task that he was assigned to do, he got it done. He got it done, and he was trustworthy. But he didn't say, oh, well, because I've been put into this position, so then, oh, look, I can take advantage of my position. Well, no. And the responses that Yosef had to Potiphar's wife, when you could say, well, he should take advantage of the position that he was put in. Well, you see Yosef's response. Hey, how can I sin against what I've been given? How can I sin against that? He's been put in this place of authority. How can I sin against that? And as you see, Yosef's life, and he falls down. You think he's falling farther and farther down, farther and farther down. Sold by his brothers. Then given a false accusation, thrown in prison. And you just think it's just going to keep tumbling, 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 and tumbling down. But no, you see that the Lord was with him, and he recognized that the Lord was with him, and he kept stepping up into what role that was given him wherever he was in that place, like in the prison. He stepped up to run the prison. He could have just sat wallowing in his own pity there in Potiphar's house. Oh, look what role. I mean, what, does the creator of heaven and earth hate me? He gives me these dreams of how I'm going to be a leader, and even my parents are going to be bowing down to me. Even some of the great patriarchs of Israel are going to be bowing down to me. My brothers are going to bow down to me. Well, they might have been bowing down to him as they looked into the cistern where they threw him before then. Some of them took him out and sold him into slavery, but it didn't look like it was headed toward that direction at all. Yet each one of these roles, he stepped up and moved forward. So you see, we saw in the passage we looked at today in John chapter 2, where Yeshua was in the temple. This is one of the accounts of it. One of the accounts where he is in the temple, and the Apostle Yochanan is specifically making the observation here, hey, this is Pesach when he's there. Well, as we've rolled back the tape long ways into Israel's history, what was the first Pesach all about? Walking death. Yes, that's right. The death was creeping through. The destroyer, the Lord sent the destroyer through Mitzrayim, through Egypt. But those plagues, and as we talk about that each year when we go through that section of the Torah, that is another example of Alpha working in a beta world, but not acting like a beta. That Aleph, the power of God, was not working like a bet. Because why? This was basically, you had Moshe coming up to Pharaoh. Who was actually in control? Was Pharaoh in control? He thought he was. Yeah. And all that just kept going was the screw kept tightening, whatever metaphor you want to say. The noose tightened, the screw was tightened more and more with each of the plagues. Turn it up. Are you going to submit, Pharaoh? Are you going to submit to the greater power? To acknowledge there is someone greater than you are, Pharaoh. There's someone greater than any of the deities that you have around you, or that so-called deities that give you power. Well, you're a superpower, Pharaoh. You're a superpower in the world. We know that historically and biblically talks about it. But where is that power actually subservient to, and where does it come from? That's right. The Lord set him up, and the Lord can take him down. And you see, with those particular plagues that were coming along, there was a Pharaoh who was lifted up high. And we talk about that with when Yosef was risen up higher and higher and higher from the depth that he had sunk down to, what also happened to Mitzrayim, to Egypt at that point? It rose higher and higher and higher. Because you see there that that power that was given to a slave that was sent, sold by his own family down into the land, that commission that was given to him to go down into the land, that consolidated all of the power, all of, because when you look through Egypt's history, you'll see the divided kingdoms, you know, Upper Egypt, which is actually south, and Lower Egypt was down near the Nile. Well, all that got consolidated under Yosef. He brought all of the so-called powers down to their knees. Christine, you have a comment or a question there?
Throughout history, right, if this is a pattern that you're pointing out, we would look for that pattern and that principle throughout our lifetimes. What's current today, what was has been done, has will be done again. So almost as if when Israel is at the beacon, even in today's world, if she rises and is, you know, aligning more and more, and her community is coming back more and more to Torah and the way of things, then superpowers, other people rise up. So when she's down, is that, could that be equated in what this pattern is? Is that something you would look at, or we could look at?
Indeed, because you see that what is it that lifted the great powers up over time? When we talk about on the global stage, some of the great empires that have come along, a lot of those are in Daniel, when Daniel talks about the great empires. What is consistent amongst all those empires? Whether you're talking about Babylon, whether you're talking about Persia, Medo-Persia, Greece, Rome, what? Yes, that's right. When you talk about salvation, when Yeshua is talking with the Samaritan woman, salvation is from the Jews, the message of God, that promise that we're talking about comes all the way from the Garden of Eden, all the way down. That is through the lineage that comes down and it gets encapsulated into a people called Israel. And it's a strong power, like under Solomon, consolidated, wrapped in all kinds of lands, dominated different powers. And it was a soft power, like when we go down through the times, like we're read about here today in 1 Kings with Eliyahu. Looks like he's, quote, on the back foot, unquote. But who's actually driving the bus there, both with the northern kingdom and with the southern kingdom? Yes, the Lord is working through the prophets, even though it looks like the kings are in command. Who is actually in command? Yeah. So that is a key pattern that we have in history. And then plus, you see, when during the time of Purim, when we go through the book of Esther, that's another example of where you see a people, they've been hauled off into captivity under not just one empire, now they're on their second empire that they're living under captivity under. And yet now, who is actually in command? That's right, the Lord is actually in command. And then you see that that is actually acknowledged, that you see both Nebuchadnezzar gets a point of clarity to that. You see under Persia, they also get a little brief little glimpse of clarity under that. And they are given commissions and anointings. Even reprehensible emperors of those empires are given anointings of a sort for a particular time period. Because why? They are following that commission that you see back in Genesis, where it says, whoever blesses you, I will bless, and whoever curses you, I will curse. Basically, see where the true power in the world is. And as we've been talking about, goes all the way back through to the Garden of Eden with the tree of life and the tree of knowledge of good and bad. Do you go with the power and the force that you think is truly in charge, or do you decide to go with what you think is actually in charge, where the source of knowledge actually is? So as we see also in this particular passage with a passage that talks about the prophet Samuel, with prophet Samuel speaking of Purim time and the book of Esther, you see in that particular time period that you have the outgrowth that Haman, it says that he is a descendant of Hamadatta, also descendant, comes down from Agag all the way down. Well, where did Agag originally come from? Comes down from the time of Amalek. So when you see, like in 1 Samuel chapter 15, the account there of where Amalek is really brought down to its knees, that promise that you see that Amalek was a force, Amalek was a force that was going through to dominate the back, the trailing forces of Israel. They were attacking whom? They were attacking the weak. They were attacking the elderly. They were bait. They were the bait forces. They were not Aleph's. They were not in that. That is a bait. That's a beta move to go after the weak, to go after those who can't fight. So what then did the Lord say? Okay, it's time to get these bait people, to bait them and finally take them off the map. And that is where you see the account in 1 Samuel chapter 15, where Shaul, or Saul, King Saul, the Prince Saul, that's his commission, saying, okay, you have been raised up. They wanted a king. They want someone who's going to act like a king. Okay, so you now act like a king. You, Saul, are going to go and dominate Amalek. Take it down. So when you read down through that, Shaul went out and he followed what the Lord's instructions were, except that it's a great account when it finally gets down there where Shemuel finally comes up. Samuel, the prophet, catches up with Saul and wants to check in with him. How did you do with the task that you were given to take down Amalek, this beta force, this folk that were just attacking from behind, attacking the weak, the vulnerable? Well, you see that this is one of those great comical lines that you'll see there when the prophet is saying, what then is this bleeding of the sheep in my ears and the lowing of the oxen? You were supposed to have taken everything out. Why do I still hear livestock? Why do I hear this? Oh, and then you start getting the excuses. It's like, well, you know, I was going to offer offerings. I was going to use these things. The Lord said, hey, you're supposed to get rid of this influence entirely. Yet, Shaul said, well, I'll just take some of it and then use it for doing good. I will use it for offerings. Yet, what did the prophet say back to him? No. Shemuel says, has the Lord as much delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as in obeying the voice of the Lord? Behold, to obey is better than sacrifice, and to heed than the fat of rams. And this comes in very important down in Israel's history, because when you see down in the latter time periods, like in the book of Yeshayahu or Isaiah, chapter 1 talks about what? A point in Israel's history where the Lord is saying, I hate your festivals. I hate your offerings. I hate your appointed times. But we see later on in the book, oh, he loves the offerings and he calls for the appointed times in the end of the book. Well, what was the problem there in chapter 1? Heart condition. Yeah, they had heart disease. It was bad. It was sick. The heart was deceptively sick. Because what is that heart talking about? Emotions and thinking. Your whole direction of who you are. And it was directing, as you see with Shaul, to start making excuses and to start looking for loopholes. Like, oh, well, I'm going to do offerings. I'm not going to obey what the Lord said because I know better. I am more merciful than the Lord is. So I am then going to allow this power to still continue on and not actually deal with the issue. So thus, what you may think of as being the Aleph move ends up being the Bait move. What you think is the Alpha move is actually the Beta move on this, and not actually taking care of the things that need to be taken care of. But also, with that allowance that your Aleph move may not be the punch in the face, the drop of the hammer. It may be you getting punched in the face and the hammer getting dropped on your head, because we see lots of examples of that in the history of the people of God. Because what do you see in Matthew chapter 5, where it talks about the Beatitudes, the Ashrei? Happy are you when, yes, happy are you when you are humbled. And you follow the words back through, and it goes the same words that you see in the Hebrew Bible talking about happy are you when you are crushed. Happy are you when you are brought low. That's what humbled is talking about. That's what meek is talking about. Happy are you when you are crushed, when you are brought low. Why? So you can stick it to the man? So you can just get back up and punch him in the face? No. That direction. Oh, sorry. Somebody's trying to get in. So I want to welcome, yes, Lee and Diane. Thank you. So that's another example that we have of Shemuel stepping up with the Aleph move. When you see a leader of Israel, was taking the Bait move, the Beta move, what was supposedly more merciful, but in the end ended up bringing misery and destruction and confusion amongst in the people. And you see something else that we saw in the passage today about Eliyahu calling fire down on the prophets, because the passage that we looked at here today was actually right after the incident at Carmel. And the incident at Carmel, as it starts out before, is with the drought, the directed drought, that the Lord was going to bring a drought through the prophet. But the issue was, what was the problem before that? There was a drought of what? The word of God. So they thought, oh, we're great. We've got enough water. We've got enough food. Everything is great. But they didn't know that they were lacking what was truly what they needed to survive. That's truly what they needed to survive, was the words and the direction of the Creator of heaven and earth. But they thought everything was just fantastic. So the Lord said, well, okay, now it's time to bring Bamidbar, bring the desert to you. So remember your generation that died in the desert, going between the land of bondage and the promised land, the land of freedom? That generation that was in there, they didn't want to trust the Lord to go into the land that had everything when they were in a land that had nothing. So they didn't want to trust the Lord to do that, even though they went through the land that had nothing. They were in the desert. Yet, what did they actually have? Their shoes didn't wear out. Their clothes didn't wear out. They were given daily bread. They were given water from a rock. They had sustenance in the midst of an area that had nothing. Yet, they wouldn't trust the one who sustained them through the place that had nothing into the land that had everything. And when they got into the land that had everything, they didn't realize where that all came from. That's, you remember, that's a part of what we are praying each time when we talk about our thanking the Lord for the food. We're thanking for this land, because if you were brought into this land, don't forget to thank the Lord. After you've eaten, had your fill, don't forget to thank the Lord. So that's where the traditions come of praying for thanks after you eat. But then that's where the tradition came about, praying before you eat, because you might forget to thank the Lord. So a quick thank you in the beginning, and then a longer thank you after, to remember where it is that everything actually comes from. So the eunuch will not think that, hey, we willed it and it happened. You know, we're just so awesome that blessings just roll down like rivers. Yes. Just pour out upon us. So that was one of the things that Eliyahu then came to remind the people. Remind the people. Now, it's a very interesting thing that you see with the northern kingdom of Israel. Because remember, you know, right after David died, and did Solomon, and then things started going downhill pretty quickly right after that. So it wasn't a united kingdom for long whatsoever, just a few decades actually. Yet, when the split happened, and they started going progressively more and more and farther away, where they actually had not just one golden calf, but two at least, and there's thought to be even more of those that they find evidence of. So they at least had two golden calves. Just not just one would work. We have to have two of them. So, don't go traveling down to Yerushalayim. So we're just going to create a whole different calendar a month later from everything. So you're not traveling down to the south. But even with all that, you still had one of the greatest prophets of the people of God ever was then sent where? To Yerushalayim? Oh, there are some great prophets that went there. He was sent to the north, to one of the worst kings and queen that you can possibly think of. Yes. So, thus, when you see the wickedness that, you know, Ahab and Jezebel, and you see the similar things, why they get mentioned again in the book of Revelation as to being a continual force, that sort of thing that can go into the people of God and draw you away to where the people that are supposed to be giving light, the prophets, are. Where are they up in the north? Hiding. Hiding. And you have this army of prophets. That's, you know, just for the so-called lords. But then there was also the ones for the so-called queens, those for Baal and Asherah. You had even more of those prophets and servants of them. So, and they're just all out in the open. They're carrying on business with the people. And so thus you have the great confrontation there at Mount Carmel. And you've got one prophet up on a hill with the crazy, crazy commands during a drought. Remember the drought that we had here just a few years ago? You know, and just think about when you see that, how much water he was calling for to then just dump over the top of an altar. And so it was like pouring down the sides and filling. I mean, you know, can you imagine if we were here in the drought and someone came by your house and you were just like hosing down the house, you know, not during a fire. Of course, they would understand that one, but just on a regular day, just out hosing the house down, you know, what would they think of that? That was just utter and complete waste. But where does the blessings of the water actually come from? Yes, it comes from the creator of heaven and earth, who created the whole water cycle to begin with, which is just marvelous. but then also can bring special favor and blessings. So, thus, you have the prophet confront them. Oh, you're worried about the drought? Okay, well, here, I'm going to just pour this water out here over the top of the altar. So there's going to be no funny business, anything going on here. And thus, even was there pulling the ultimate Aleph move over there, mocking the prophets on the other side. Yes. So he was mocking them, saying, you know, hey, keep at it. And it talks about that they were cutting themselves. Because, you know, when you see, this is a common thing that comes across in a lot of different pagan cultures about cutting yourselves to do what? To get attention. And sadly, that even continues now, even today, with children. They'll even cut themselves for a similar thing, maybe not for a deity, but to get attention or to even consider whether they're actually even alive or not. So these things are common across cultures across the planet where people will try to get the attention of some deity. And you see what happened here on the North, South America, Central America with the Aztec Empire. Oh my goodness. But that's not any uncommon to what you'll see in some other cultures around the world of trying to get the attentions of the deities. Shout louder, cut yourselves, cut other people, just make a complete disaster to try to get the attention of your deity. But then you see what Eliyahu, he called out to heaven, acknowledging where the true source of help comes from. And then the fire came down, just like what Christine was talking about, burned up the offering, burned up the altar. It nuked the entire platform there, the water, everything that was in that, around that altar. Just burned it, evaporated it, all gone. So when you see, well, who is actually in control the whole time? So you would think if you were a witness to this and you see some of the reactions of the people who are witnessing this, you've been following this whole army of prophets and so-called people, gurus, you might call them, priests, priestesses, that are supposedly connecting you to the divine. Well, they were out there all day working themselves into a lather and bleeding and nothing. You have one prophet from a group that most of them are in hiding, from the sense of scorn that the Northern Kingdom had for these prophets and the God that they served. Utter scorn and contempt. They weren't out just being able to speak freely. They were in hiding. Yet, the people saw who was actually truly in charge. And so we see the same thing here today, is when we see our brothers and sisters in the family of God, they're in all kinds of terrible conditions all over the world. And you see their testimonies where, you know, we sadly in the past 2 decades have seen lots of incredibly graphic things of what those forces like those up on Carmel was trying to do to get our brothers and sisters to bend the knee to some other Baal, whatever you want to call it. Paint signs on the door. Hey, this is the place. If you want to take out one of the believers of the so-called infidels, here, this is where you go. Drag them out down to a beach, end their lives on video. It's broadcast all over the world. But what then is the response from the believers? Prayer. And that power to go on, even if there is destruction that's coming even to your house. So it's like when you see what is the true power in the world. And, you know, we'll see examples talked about in schools and in public culture talking about where things come from. And they'll go on and on with animations and millions and hundreds of millions of dollars put towards the various production efforts and marketing efforts to get this message out about where things come from, come about things spontaneously. Whereas you have the writings that have been preserved for thousands of years that have come through say, hey, in the beginning, there was one who created everything, and he created them male and female. Male and female, he created them. And you'll see that everything reproduces after its kind. Giraffes, the different kinds of things, well, you can know what to expect from one generation of one organism to the next generation of another organism. And when you have various chemicals, various elements, a lot of smart people have figured out these things over time, how the various elements are constructed, how they work together, how they can do all kinds of amazing things. Like we all got here today by lots and lots and lots and lots of engineering in the cars. But even with all that engineering that goes into it, how long do they last? They're breaking down all the time, having to repair them and this and that and the other. I mean, we're talking about the creator who, with our bodies for much of our lives, repairs stuff. I mean, wouldn't it be great if your car repaired itself? Yeah, wouldn't that be awesome? You just, you know, stuff some broccoli in your tank and suddenly it fixes itself. Wouldn't that be awesome? Yeah, you have a new car. Wouldn't that be great? But that is the difference. It's like being up on Mount Carmel again. You've got this whole noise going on the other side, lots with the whole support of the powers that be that are yelling away up there on Mount Carmel. But what is actually moving and is the real power in the world? They can have the power as long as they can crush. They can dominate around. But again, when you're looking at whether it's an Aleph world or a Beit world, eventually those who are Beit will learn that there's always someone with what? A bigger stick. So are they truly in command? They may be in command for a season, but there's always something to dominate them otherwise. And what we've seen, continue to see throughout the history of Israel and throughout the history that's brought to us through the Bible, is that the true Aleph power in the world is the Creator and those who the Creator commissions, sends forth, sends them out. And it may not look like being in command, just like it didn't look like Yosef was in command. Didn't look like Moshe was in command, because it looked like he was coming hat in hand to Pharaoh. But who was eventually begging in the end? Pharaoh. Yes, Christine.
Again, just such a great pattern and principle, even in our own lives today as believers, when we try to, I'm sure I'm not the only one guilty of this, fix, manage, and control, right? So public relations, you know, accounting, whatever it may be. The beauty is when you finally, for real, rest in, you know, the Hebrew concept of bitachon, which is the ultimate trust, and emunah, which is the ultimate faith that no matter what happens, that everything has to pass by Hashem. And it's used as a test or a glory or a victory or to bring something that needs to be addressed out and through so that we come back and we or stay here and just announce the beauty of ultimately resting. For real, even Hasatan has to come by with his plans and have them approved. It's amazing. And, you know, our own evil inclination, we have to rule over and submit and, you know, say, it is written, there's just great glory in it and the things that we're taught. And this pattern and principle that you brought up today about being an alpha power, there's few that are called out, like Pinchas and Elijah, and, you know, those are great, and it's a very fine group of tzaddiks that are called to that. But for me in my life, a vengeance is the Lord, because there is nothing tampered in that area for me. I could not be zealous in my own right, in my own power, for sure. I'd be shooting now and apologizing later. Metaphorically, of course, I own no handguns.
Yeah. Well, you know, one of the things that you had talked about before was taking these evil inclinations that we have and figuring out whether they are evil inclinations or not. And that is, you know, the Apostle Paul talks about taking every thought captive and bringing it into submission to the law of the Mashiach. Well, we call that in modern parlance using an algorithm. Because whether, no matter what you're talking about today, whether it's some sort of social media platform or something or other, everybody's using an algorithm. And what is an algorithm? It's just a fancy mathematical formulas that run things through, and it will shun things this way and that way and guide in today guide decisions that you make or think you want to make or didn't know you wanted to make. So those algorithms can take the input that comes in and move it to one direction or the other. Now, the question is that when you have your inputs, it's this inclination that you have, something that's popped into your skull, something that you've got, you emotion, some sort of a sense, a desire that you have, what then do you do with that? You have to do what? You got to pattern match it against something else. When you have algorithms work by taking the input in and running it through and comparing it to something else, a storehouse of something. Whether you're talking about a Facebook, they've got in their algorithm, they've got a whole storehouse of things to decide what to do with what input is coming in, what you're typing into a search, whether you're clicking on this, clicking on that. They will then decide what to do based on that input that's coming in. And they have a whole storehouse of things that they will compare that against. So we as believers, when we talk about taking every thought captive, these things that come in, thoughts, desires, emotions that come in, we compare it against something. We compare it against every word that proceeds out of the mouth of God. And boy, that is difficult when in the moment of things. But, you know, sometimes people will talk about, you know, stepping back and looking at yourself in a given situation. I know I found that helpful to get out of the moment of a thing when I'm just really wrapped up and emotional about something, to step back and look at myself. If I was looking at myself, what would I think of myself behaving this way? So then what am I comparing my opinion of what I look like in dealing with this situation against? That's every word that proceeds out of the mouth of God. So thus, you're taking these things, instead of just kind of being, as the Apostle Yaakov there in James chapter 1 talks about, you're like a, if you don't seek the wisdom of God when you face these trials, when you face issues in life, you will be like a ship that's tossed back and forth. You know, and if you've ever seen like videos of deep sea, either fishing boats or sometimes you even see freighters, gigantic super tankers that are tossed back and forth, because even though the boat is hundreds of feet long, the waves are huge. The waves are sometimes up to 100 feet high. And so these boats are just get tossed back and forth like it looks like a little lifeboat. Yet, in the sense of this, are you just at the mercy of this, of the waves as they come? Or do you have a direction that no matter if you do not see what the horizon is, you have your spiritual GPS, you've got your spiritual compass that can keep you on course, whether you can see the horizon or not, and whether you think you are right side up or not, Because sometimes, I know, like, and sometimes your inner ear, if you've been at sea for a long time, gets so screwed up that you don't even know if you're right side up or not. I know, like, after I got to shore, after being at the sea for, like, 3 or 4 days in 20 or 30 foot seas, that it was like, it was hard to act. And talk about getting your land legs back. That was, it's the truth, because your inner ear is still going. So do we have our own compass? Do we have our own artificial horizon that no matter if we can see the horizon or not, you talk to pilots and, you know, it's a sad thing when your artificial horizon gets screwed up, and it has happened, is where those things malfunction. But one of the things that they'll teach you is trust your instruments, because one of the things, I had the sad experience of going out with a friend of mine in college who was a aviation major, and he was taking his instrument training, and they would purposely go in and they put them under the hood, meaning you can't see anything outside and you're just looking at your instruments. And then they'll like screw you up and the instructor will just put you into this or that, put you into a turn or something like that. And you're just supposed to, from your instruments, right yourself again, get yourself back on course, back on level, and keep going. So when we face these things in life, you know, are we just going to be like tossed back and forth, or are we just going to be looking at the hordes of people against us, like Eliyahu was up there on Carmel? Or is it that we have an artificial horizon, which is every word that proceeds out of the mouth of God, that keeps us on the level, no matter what crazy things that we might say, where everybody is saying something completely different, and yet the word says this, and we're like, okay, well, which am I going to trust? Which has been with me the good times and the bad times? What can I depend upon? So what will actually write the course? Do you have a question, Deborah? Or?
Yesterday I had this experience, and they're bringing it up, and it's so very often that when what's going on in our study for the week, that there's an incident that comes up, and it ties right into this. And I was working, I've been working with this lady for about 4 weeks, her and her husband, and I told her I couldn't work 7 days a week. And she, yesterday she came to a realization I wasn't going to work for the weekend. And she, became, so upset, you know, and it's kind of like threatened the job, you know, and said, well, wait till Monday. And I was standing there and I just, my mouth was open and I was going to say something to her, and I was just going on. And then that tape rolled and said, you know what? Okay. Maybe she'll let you go. Maybe you won't have this job. Look what God did. You know, I had to say these things to me, to myself, because I thought, you know, I was going to really just go, oh my God, you know, and I just stood there. A tear rolled out of my eye. I didn't want it to. But, you know, she went into a really weird direction and said, oh, you're pushing me. And I barely said anything. So I became frightened. And when her husband got up, she said something to him, and he goes, we're not slave drivers. People can't work 7 days a week. And she really was fastened on that. But I think she's a Christian, and she was operating out of fear. And I didn't know what to say, but everything inside was telling me, zip, zip. You know, and I do have to trust God, because if that job is not there and she wants somebody for 7 days, then okay, time to move on. But that is a very fearful place to be, of when you look at yourself and you really do have to not react, because I barely said anything and it did not go in the direction I thought, you know, because I have a habit of defending myself. Oh, but I didn't do this. And I have to stop that, because that has been a some odd year pattern with me, is defend.
Well, praise God about that. Yeah. Praise God about that. Yes, Alma, go ahead, please.
I believe that we have to control our thoughts, positive or negative, especially the negatives, because those thoughts, and to turn them into God, because from those thoughts lead to feelings, and those feelings lead to actions.
That is, when you say the counsel that we have in the word today about the bringing things into submission and filtering things through, this is ancient. It goes back thousands of years of these writings that we have. Yet, it's some of the best advice that we have for some of the most modern crises that we have, both personally, nationally, whatever. Yes, Carrie, go ahead, please.
I was just going to say, kind of for me, combining what you're saying with even what Deborah's experience was, is, going back to following a pattern, a particular pattern. And the thing is that when we run into these situations, if we haven't spent time in the Word studying and strengthening our minds and our hearts, our what some people call emotional intelligence, which is control over our emotions so they don't get out of control, if we haven't spent the time on a regular basis practicing that and studying that, we're not going to do what God wants us to do when we get into those situations. So we can't just walk through life thinking, oh, spiritually, God will help me, you know, he'll help me control myself in these situations. That's not how he operates. He tells us to study ourselves to show ourselves approved. So just that part of it, you know, yeah, there's a pattern we need to study so that we can follow it.
Yeah, indeed. You know, because when you have the counsel from the Apostle Paul, when he talks about, you know, be always ready to have an answer for the hope that's within you. Okay, that's when people are challenging what it is that you believe. And when you see the context of that, that's talking about, well, why do you think that Yeshua as the Mashiach is extremely important for the people of God? But that's just one aspect of it. When you take that then further, you have to have other things from the Word of God in place. Because when you are taking your thoughts captive and bringing them into submission, submission to what? If you don't have it in your skull to begin with, I mean, you all know what happens if you cram for a test, right? You don't learn. It's the things that you do day in, day out, day in, day out, day in, day out. They stick with you. Like, there is all kinds of quadratic equations and stuff that I learned. I learned, you know, how to integrate and stuff like that from calculus. Do I remember any of that? No, I don't remember a thing of that. What I do remember, I remember how to do percentage change equations. I know how to do those things. Why? Because I do that several times a day. I'm always doing percentage change equations. So that is one thing that I know extremely well. And, you know, it can help my coworkers with that because that's something that I do quite often. If there is something that you practice on a lot of occasions, that you get, when it's talking about something that's physical, you get the muscle memory involved where you practice a motion so much that you can do it and not even think about that. Like one of the musicians that has always inspired me, you know, he can play fantastic bass lines. I mean, just the most intricate bass lines and sing at the same time. And the melody he's singing is not on the same tempo as what he's playing on the bass. And they ask, well, how on earth do you do that? Well, I first learned the bass part. And I play that so I don't even have to think about that. So then when I'm singing, I'm thinking about my singing because I've already learned the bass line and I can play that without even thinking about that whatsoever. So how much more then as we as believers, when we're talking about God's words, that we have those things in our algorithm so that when we get hammered with these inputs that come at us all the time, that those things are just right there, ready. We don't have to go trying to find, well, where was that? I think I heard somebody say something about that. Those are things that are stored up in our hearts, stored up within us, so that then we can just draw on them whenever we need to. So, lastly, we'll close out here with the passage there in Acts chapter 4 and chapter 5 that brings lots of consternations because you have a lot of our fellow brothers and sisters in the body of Messiah will think that some of the things that we see like in the Torah and the prophets and the writings about, you know, like when Shmuel is getting rid of Agag, didn't all that end like in the Old Testament? Then you get this passage like you see in Acts chapter 4 and chapter 5 with the issue of Ananias and Sapphira, or Sapphira. And that scares a lot of people because while that sounds, quote, Old Testament, unquote, but what was the real issue? Because when you see in that particular passage that this situation was about not just that they were bringing something forward that they should have released to the Lord, but when you start reading in Acts chapter 4, starting in verse 32, and the congregation of those who believed were of one heart and soul, and not one of them claimed that anything belonged to him was his own, but all things were in common property to them. And with the great power of the apostles were giving testimony to the resurrection of the Lord Yeshua, and abundant grace was upon them all. For there was not a needy person among them, for all who were owners of land or houses would sell them and bring the proceeds and sales and lay them at the apostles' feet, and they would be distributed to each person as he had need. Now Joseph of Levi of Cyprian birth, who was also called Barnabas by the apostles, which translated means son of encouragement, and who owned a tract of land, sold it and brought the money and laid it at the apostles' feet. But a man named Ananias and his wife Sapphira sold a piece of property and brought back some of the price for himself. With his wife's full knowledge and bringing a portion of it, he laid it at the apostles' feet. But Cephas said, Ananias, why has Satan filled your heart to lie to the Holy Spirit and to keep back some of the price of the land? While it remained unsold, did it not remain your own? And after it was sold, was it not under your control? Why is it that you have conceived this deed in your heart? You have not lied to men, but to God. And as he heard these words, Ananias fell down and breathed his last, and great fear came over all who heard of it. The young men got up and covered him up, and after carrying him out, they buried him. Now there elapsed an interval of about 3 hours, and his wife came in, not knowing what had happened, and Cephas responded to her, tell me whether you have sold the land for such and such a price. And she said, yes, that was the price. And Cephas said to her, why is it that you have agreed together to put the spirits of the Lord to the test? Behold, the feet of those who have buried your husband are at the door, and they will carry you out as well. And immediately she fell at his feet and breathed her last. And the young men came in and found her dead. And they carried her out and buried her beside her husband. And great fear came over the entire assembly, over all who heard of these things. So, when we're always looking at these passages, you always have to look at the punchline. What is the punchline of this passage? A lot of people think, oh, they're carried out one, they carried out the other. Everybody's just dropping dead right at Peter's feet. Wow, don't get on Peter's bad side, otherwise you're going to fall over dead too. Yes, we have a comment or a question back there. Don't lie to God, okay? That's a good punchline. But the thing that is very interesting that you might say is a good punchline for this is actually back a little bit earlier when Cephas is saying to her, well, you know, back when he was talking with Ananias, trying to see the passage here. Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. While it remained unsold, did it not remain your own? See, a lot of people can get the, when it talks about there in chapter 4, they had everything in common and they would just sell their property and this and that. It was like, well, that was an obligation for everybody. Everybody, if you are a part of the body of Messiah, you just sold everything. The question is that were you willing to sell everything and under what heart condition were you actually selling these things? Because remember what Yeshua himself said to somebody who came to him. And he talked about how great he was in the knowledge of the Torah and the observance of the Torah. And Yeshua told him what? One thing you lack, which is what? Go, sell all that you have and give it to the poor. And what was his reaction? He went away sad because he had many things. Yes, we have a comment or a question back there. So the punchline
might be that his thoughts and intentions behind keeping the money.
Yes. Why was he actually bringing the money forward? Yes. See, that's the thing, was to be seen as bringing forward the money. Because it's important that the example of who came in right before, or is mentioned right before he came in to bring it, that this guy sold it and he brought in and laid the proceeds down. So then what, you know, if you were to just see what the expectation was, if someone was to bring in proceeds, what would everybody looking at that think? You sold that, and what you got from that is now sitting at the apostles' feet. So then when Ananias comes in and is bringing money and putting it down there at the apostles' feet, what then would the thought be of everyone? Well, just like the other guy, this must be, he sold the property and here it is. Here are the proceeds for it. So the issue is not like, did you keep the property? Because Kepha said to him, hey, when you owned it, it's yours. It's not like, you know, we own your property, so you better give it over. No, it's like, that's your property, but if you feel like there is a need for it and you want to share it with others, do so. But also, if you're going to make the public gesture of bringing the proceeds in, don't misrepresent what it is that you're doing. A very similar thing happened in Israel's history, which we mentioned in Isaiah chapter 1, was that people were bringing in what kinds of offerings? Blemished, sick, worst. It's like, oh, let's see, oh, something, oh boy, I don't, no one would buy that one. Here, let's take it to the temple. I mean, you know, you're giving basically your food scraps and bringing it to God as your offerings, as your best. Stuff that you would throw in the garbage or try to slough off to somebody, that you're bringing in as saying, I am loving you with all of my heart and with all of my soul and with all of my strength. And this is what I'm bringing to you. Stuff that I hope someone would buy, because I wouldn't buy it. And I'm just looking for someone else to take it. So is that then what it is, the attitude that we bring forward to God? This is another bait move. The alpha move is what's the person who came in before saying, there is a need. I've got something that can fulfill the need. I'm taking care of it. And he brings it in. And this is his whole heart's intent. He's bringing it forward saying, I got the resources for this. Here it is. Not like, well, I needed some extra cash, so let me liquidate this. I'm going to take some of this over here to pay some of my stuff off. And then the rest, I'll give over for the effort. So what is it that is actually happening within your heart in this? Yes, the heart issue, again. And so thus, that is truly a determinant between the moves that we have that go from a bait move to an aleph move, is where is our hearts on it? Are we so concerned about our own self that that part of the Shema gets lost? Love the Lord with all your heart, mind, your emotions, with all your soul, that's your life, and with all of your me'od, or your strength, your resources. That is loving the Lord completely, all three of those things together. If there's a part of those that's divided or conflicted, then you end up having significant challenges with it. Yes, Larry, you got a comment or a question over there?
Well, in that particular operation, he could have said, is this the money that you got for the property? Well, it's most of it, but I had a couple of debts I had to pay.
Just okay. Be upfront with it. Yes, and because that's the thing that Kepha was asking him. Did you sell it and this is what the price was? And she said, yes. Well, yeah, he had already been inspired to know what the actual answer to that was. So what is it that you're actually trying to achieve here, Sapphira and Ananias? What is it you're trying to achieve? Who do you think you're fooling here? You know, you're not fooling the creator of heaven and earth. And since the creator of heaven and earth filled in Kepha about what was actually happening here, you're not fooling him either. So who is it that you're actually fooling? Yourself. Yourself. Yeah, that's who it is that you're fooling with this kind of behavior. Now, what brings it, did you? Oh, yes, Rose, please go ahead.
It's obvious that couple was deceptive. But what's wrong with saying I sold it for this much, but I'm willing to share this much?
Yeah, that's kind of what Larry was saying. Well, if they had just said, hey, yeah, that would be saying it better. Oh, yes. But yes, what you're both are saying is indeed correct. Had they just been upfront, it's like, hey, you got a need here. I've got some land. I'm going to liquidate it. I need some of this to take care of this. Here's some rest of stuff. Fine. You know, today they have these things about, you know, charitable remainder trusts and various things that you can do. And you can use like little proceeds of something to take care of this or that or the other. But what is the intent of the whole fund that you're doing? To take care of the charitable effort. That's why you set the thing up. Yes.
Deborah, go ahead. This scripture probably still does make me feel bad. I had, you know, my inheritance, or I've had some money, and part of me is like, oh, I got to give, you know, such and such amount of this money. And the reality is that, you know, I don't know if it's trusting or not trusting God, but if I gave that up, I don't know where my rent would come from and my bills, because they're much higher than they ever were. But so, you know, I think a lot of the times the scripture is very confusing because you don't have all the backdrop. You just pick out what you want out of it, or you've heard something from the pulpit about your money, you know, and if you trust God, you're going to give up all that money, you know, without any wisdom. It's not my money, you know, and so there's got to be, you know, some training where you're...
I'm glad you bring that up, because we'll close with this the thought here, and which brings us back around to the passage we're talking about here with Pinchas, because inside there's this strange little vignette about the daughters of Zelophehad. And it's a very interesting picture, because we see here that you can have a change of the Torah, a change of the law. And where did you also hear about saying, hey, we want to participate, but the Torah does not allow us to participate in this great and good thing? Second Passover is the other one. And that was a special provision saying, hey, we want to be a part of Pesach. Pesach is hugely important, and it's a huge memorial that comes around every year about where it is that we're freed from, both as a people and in individuals. But the laws are also there, which are about teaching about the separation that we have from death and corruption and contamination from death, because of the great symbols that are there in the tabernacle itself. It is to teach that the realm of God is all about life. It is not about death, not contact with death. Death is separated out. The things that are dying and dead do not come into the house of God. Now, with those people who want to be involved, who have had, there's been a death in the family. They've had to go take care of a corpse. Whatever the issue was, that they had become contaminated by a corpse, so thus they could not get involved with Pesach. They said, Lord, we want to be involved. Are we just completely left out of the situation? And there was like, okay, the petition goes to God and it comes back. Here you go. This is what you do. There is now, for those of you who wanted to be, but you just could not because you had to be far away or some other reason why you could not participate in Pesach. So thus, in the second month, almost like same sort of timing, just do it 1 month later. Thus, there is the second Pesach for you. And thus, you also have with the daughters of Zelophehad, That is the provision where daughters then become a part of the inheritance of the land. Because they say, hey, this is not like the rule of the patriarchy here, and we want to fight against the patriarchy. No, this is about this thing that God is building. We want to be involved, but because there's no sons in the family, it's just not going to happen here with that. So what then is there for us? And the instruction comes back is that, hey, the intent for the inheritance is for the men to deal with it. Frankly, because men, we need to have a kick in the, to get involved with the things of God, to step up and be the Aleph in the people of God. But functionally, if you just have a family that has no sons to carry things on here with the inheritance, thus that provision is in here for the daughters of the family to carry that on. So thus, that's a very interesting picture of what Deborah was talking about there, in that in this sort of a situation, we think, oh, well, we are being hamstrung by what it is the instructions of God are saying. But then what is the intent that we have? Is our intent to bring, as it's often talked about in rabbinical literature, is your tradition, is your way of walking, your halakha, is it making the Torah stand up or is it making it fall down? Now, if what we are wanting to have is a provision for the daughters of Zelophehad for the second Passover, that was, we want the Torah to stand up. We want it to be held up high. So thus, this ordinance, this basically judicial ruling from on high says, okay, this is what we do in this particular situation so that you can have people get involved. And so thus, with what you're talking about, Deborah, that's why when we are looking at what our intentions are on this, what is actually going on inside of us? For the situation we were looking at there in Acts 4 and 5, okay, if we've got needs and we need to, what we call, to monetize our assets, to use modern parlance there, to sell it so that we have money to take care of things, well, then how is it that we actually go about that? There's going to be a sale, and some of it we take care of what we need to, and then what are we going to do with the rest of it? Go to proverbial Vegas? Or is it that there's the need? Yes, so we're going to invest it with the things that are eternal, the needs that are out there that we take care of. So, Deborah, yeah, go ahead, please.
Two questions. One's a comment, one's a question. One is, hell is paved with good intentions. And another is, I was just talking to Carrie and about, when you do the second Passover, just say I came in a day before and I was being around a dead body. So do the 7 days of unleavened bread, do I participate with it then or during Passover? Do I do 7 days of unleavened bread then? Just curious.
Yeah,
I don't know what you're...
It's basically hitting the reset button for you. Yeah. That's there's varying opinions on that because it's not specifically stated, but there's the camps that say you hit it, you do it as if it was you were doing it for the first time, which makes sense because of the instruction that's offered there. Then there's the camp that says, well, you missed it, you're just out of luck. Well, no, you're not actually hitting the reset button in that sense and getting the spirit of the law, so to speak. Yes, Larilla, you have a comment or a question over there?
I just wanted to say that this fellowship is really, really good about when you need a second Pesach. And so when you're in Ireland and you can't get anything that doesn't have leavening in it for the first Pesach, you call up Jeff and you Zoom. And so while you're in a hotel for a week in Oregon, we did, by Zoom, we did second Pesach, and it was really meaningful to me that I was still able to participate. And so, again, I thank you and Tammy for extending that.
That is the whole point of both of these examples, of the second Pesach and the daughters of Zelophehad, so that those who want to be involved are not left out.
You've been listening to a discussion at Hillel Fellowship. If you would like to hear more discussions or if you have any questions, visit the website at hillel.info. That's H-A-L-L-E-L.info. Hillel.info.